Resonance of Am, 104.4.
The first radio. It was a box with a cat's whiskers. Well, it's a little glass tube on top of the box, and to get the station, you had to twiddle a wire on this end here against a crystal in there, and that would change the station. But there was always a fight, because everybody wanted, there was only one set of earphones.
My name's Buffalo Bill, and you're listening to The Bike Show on Resonance FM. Thanks, Paul, for another great Art Rocker show. No live band this time. There'll be another live band on the Art Rocker show in 5 years' time. If you missed it last week, you missed it. This week on The Bike Show, we're talking about four great lives in cycling, spanning the length and breadth of the 20th century, well, maybe a little bit of the 19th century too. Well, I have in the studio Mr. Tim Dawson, cycling columnist for the Sunday Times and the editor of the Cycling Books website, the best place to find out what is new and what is interesting in the world of cycling books. Welcome to the show.
Good evening, Jack.
You made it in. Unlike our other guest, Graham, who's hanging on the line, we'll bring him in a minute. He is stuck, Graham Fife, author and also friend of the Bike Show. He is stuck in the North Downs, where he lives down there by Sevenoaks. But you made it in, that's good.
It's a brutal night for cycling in London, but yes, I battered my way over London Bridge and here I am.
So let's get straight into it, I think. Let's get straight into it with great life number one on tonight's show.
Kuklos. He's...
I never heard of him. This is brilliant. This is the first one. I mean, I think I know a little bit about bicycling and some of the interesting personalities involved with cycling, and I haven't heard of this. Kuklos.
Well, he was a journalist who wrote a weekly column about cycling for 40 years, starting, I mean, his cycling work started in 1895, and he rarely missed a week until around 1935. He died in 37, writing in the Daily News for the most part, sort of pieces of between 1,500 and 4,000 or 5,000 words. He sort of maps out an incredible period in cycling. His earlier pieces, sort of in the 1900s, are very much talking about exploring the roads of Britain, Ireland and France, really for the first time in 50 years or so. You know, he's obviously of the very earliest generation of cyclotourists, and he writes with huge enthusiasm about discovering these roads in the Yorkshire Dales, for example, where he spent a lot of time cycling, which, you know, had been important drove roads before the railways, but were little seen in the period from the coming of the railways until cars started to become frequent sights in the 1930s. So his early columns are this kind of exploration of the countryside and cycling for those who would like to follow him. But as he matured as a writer, he started talking more about cycling as a phenomena. And I think that's what really fascinates me about his work, because he starts mapping out this idea of cycling being, or the bicycle, being an exceptional product of the manufacturing age. And he started sort of describing ways of thinking about cycling that I think an awful lot of us, even now, have at the kind of core of our being. And he was one of the first people who really started mapping that out, that there was something unusual and special about bicycles, and that, you know, this sort of very simple piece of machinery liberated human beings in a way that was quite unique in the manufactured age. And it's that, the way that he started mapping that out, that really interests me about him.
Because this is normally the kind of thing that you hear people on the continent talking about, your Velocios and those kind of characters, talking about a little bit more the philosophical aspect of things. Because there's plenty of cycling books from the first and the second bike booms, which is, you know, how to get from London to Brighton and the Cambridge Road and things like that. But this is the more esoteric approach.
Well, it is. And he complains very bitterly. Probably his most sort of famous and important essay, which is called On Wiggling, which is a kind of response to a rather angry comment that John Ruskin had made about cyclists. He maps out why he thinks bicycles are important and why cyclists are being sold short by manufacturers, because there's this... I suppose the trajectory of cycling is that by the 1890s, it was this huge craze and, you know, the upper classes went crazy for it and you could go to Regent's Park and see Lord This and Lady That on their bicycles. But that came to an end almost before 1900, and particularly with the, you know, with the Great War, cycle manufacturing took a huge backward step, and bicycles got worse and worse and worse for a long period, probably until the 1950s. Bikes were getting worse, and he complained bitterly, and he was clearly sort of agitating at manufacturers, saying, "Make them a bit better. You know, this is an amazing recreation that thousands of people want to do, but you, the manufacturers, are selling them short." And he sort of has all sorts of humorous examples of how big manufacturers like Sunbeam have been shown how they could make better bikes, and just they're not interested.
Is this the idea that great manufacturing inventiveness and innovation that went into the early bicycles just got diverted into the motor car industry?
Yes, and bicycles came to... I mean, there is this period pre-motor car when bicycles were being made and sort of quite exceptional engineering ingenuity and skills were being brought to bear on it to make vehicles for wealthy people. Once the car started taking away that market, and once mass transit systems like buses and undergrounds started taking that market away, some of the bicycle manufacturers got out of bikes and went into motorcycles and cars. Others just started knocking out increasingly third-rate machines aimed at far less wealthy potential cyclists. And they got rubbisher and rubbisher. They got heavier and heavier. I mean, I haven't measured them myself, but I'm told that you know, you take the better bikes of the 1900s and they are massively superior to most bikes of the 1930s. And it's actually from that, you know, that's why the little craft manufacturers like Mercian and Bob Jackson and Holdsworth started making bikes for an enthusiast crowd in little workshops in northern England.
So back to our great life, Kuklos. How can people delve into him? How can they read his books? Are they available?
Well, they're not in print, sadly. In fact, they're long out of print. The most accessible of his books, the Kuklos Papers, you can find reasonably easily secondhand for £20 or £30. There are one or two of his articles online which can be read for free. So you do have to hunt around a bit, but it's quite a prize when you find one.
When did he pass into the next world, and what implication does that have for the copyright on his writings?
1937, so it's almost entirely out of copyright. So it would be an opportunity for somebody, actually, to, you know, perhaps do a new collection of them.
So you can read, presumably, some of the reviews or at least summaries of the books on your website, right?
You can. I put Of Wiggling up because it seemed to me like quite an important piece, and I hope more people would enjoy it. I spent a long time looking for his works. I knew of his works. The other thing that he did, he produced an annual book about cycling, which was a kind of directory both of his wisdom and of, you know, when the York Cycle Rally was and stuff like that. And the later editions, the editions of post-Second World War, didn't have that much to do with him, but certainly the ones in the 20s and 30s were his sort of annual digest of information. And you sometimes see those for £5 or £6.
Well, A Great Life in print, Kuklos. Well, let's move on now to Graham Fife. And we'll bring Graham Fife on the telephone apparatus all the way from Sevenoaks just after this.
Oh,
This is the sound of blind Mamie Forehand with her version of Honey in the Rock, making excellent use of the bicycle bell and I think a bicycle wheel as well. What better way than to segue to Graham Fife, who I hope to bring in on the line now. Graham, can you hear us?
Yes, I can.
Welcome to the Bike Show, Graham. Graham, your great life this evening, your contribution to this evening's show is a great life of Brian Robinson, pioneer of British cycling, the first Brit to make it really big on the continent as a professional cyclist. And you've just got a book out about Brian. Just before we get on to Brian, describe a little bit the time when Brian was beginning to be a professional bike racer and thinking of going to France.
Well, the early 50s were, in the view of many, one of the toughest eras of cycling. I mean, after the war, I think we'd go back to the beginning of the race itself, and that's just a different epoch. I think the thing is that about the time when Brian was racing, it was really quite hard to make a good living on the continent racing. Difficult to land professional contracts. The Tour de France, of course, dominated the scene then as it does now. But in those days, it was even more important because if you're racing for one of the international teams, one of the national teams, I should say, you really did make good money. But the rest of them were scrapping around for really not terribly much. And the professional cyclist who wanted to make a go of it was racing from something like February through to October.
I mean, and as well as the demands of professional cycling on the continent, it was a world away from Britain, from Yorkshire, where Brian grew up, right?
Oh, yes, absolutely. I mean, he went over in 1952 for the first time, rode the Route de France, which is now the Tour de l'Avenir, with the Army and the NCU, and then went back in 1954, rode the Tour of Europe. But, I mean, it was only eight years after the war the place was devastated. France was still pretty well in social turmoil. The roads weren't that good. The society, one may say, was pretty closed down, concerned, preoccupied with its own difficulties post-war. And just to go across the channel to land in France was really quite a big deal. So for somebody to come from a small village, effectively, in West Yorkshire and make his way over to France, and then to adapt so brilliantly as he did, took huge resilience of mind and temperament, and also huge intelligence and determination.
Well, let's hear from Brian himself. I was at your book launch last week in London, as was Brian, and I took 5 minutes just in the workshop at Look Mum No Hands away from the crowd to ask him what it was that motivated him to make that leap across the channel.
I didn't realise at the time that it was going to be like this. You know, I wanted to be a bike rider and went over to France and decided if that's what they could do, so could I.
What would you put your success down to?
Good question. I think the main thing about bike riding is being able to recover overnight, and I think I was pretty good at that. I think that was my strongest point, really. But obviously you've got to train hard, you've got to think right, you've got to do the whole job as it should be done, like the French do. And that was my ambition to do that.
Was there quite a difference in the cycling cultures, the pro cycling cultures?
Oh, it was another 5 miles an hour plus, if you like. And if you couldn't make that step, you were nowhere. Well, fortunately, I was able to make that step gradually. And had some success in the end, the end of the day, really. But that was purely because I adopted the French way of life, I think. A lot of my pals that went over, I mean, we were a full team to start with, they were hankering after things that we had in England, like Yorkshire pudding and roast beef dinners, you know, and that never bothered me whatsoever. I got stuck into the French way of life and liked it. I didn't have any sort of hang-ups, if you like, of going back home, you know. Although when we did come back home, it was always the first meal was in the fish shop, the fish and chip shop, because that's something stuck in your mind, really. Something you enjoy. I still enjoy that today. Every month we go to a fish and chip shop. But when you were racing, fish and chips were out, of course. You couldn't take, you didn't have to eat those.
Was there a different approach to training and preparation for races?
Yes, the training was more structured. I mean, we just went out and rode bikes. That was the British attitude at that time, but it was more structured in France. It was a build-up from 15th of January. You rode very short rides, and then by the time you got to end of March, you were riding long rides like 250 kilometres and that sort of thing. So it was the season was longer and more structured, but the weather was better. That made a big difference, of course.
And looking at professional cycling now, is it a different world from what it was in your
day? I would like
day?
To be there now. The money's a lot better. But no, we've made progress. I mean, from my day when there was one of us, if you like, or two, now we can field a full team probably twice now with good riders, and we've got the fastest man in the world anyway now. So we have made progress, but it's taken 50 years.
What do you think about Team Sky?
They've certainly got all the gear there. They've got the money's behind them. It's the guys that have to perform now. But as usual, it's the guys that have to really want to do it.
Do you think Bradley Wiggins has got it in him to win the Tour de France or one of the big Grand Tours?
He's going to struggle. He's got to get his act together and be really focused on the Tour itself. There's no messing about in the Tour. You've got to be really on the ball for 3 weeks, no bad moments, and you've got to be focused, and the team around you has got to be focused. You can't do it without a team, as has been proved. You know, I mean, in my day, England didn't have a team apart from once, and when we did have a team, it wasn't capable. So I never got a good ride in the Tour because I didn't have a team.
That was Brian Robinson. Graham, we're going to have to hurry on, but your book is out now, Brian Robinson, Pioneer. You clearly like him. Was he pleased with the book?
He said the other week that he'd, because his eyes have been really bad, but he said he'd, and he just got a copy, and he said he got to page 103 and he was really quite enjoying it. I emailed back and I said, well, of course, it's downhill from there. No, I think he is enjoying it, yes, of course, I do like the man hugely and I admire him much.
Well, the book is out with Mousehold Press, and it's. I've got a copy here in front of me, which I bought with my own penny. Didn't get you to sign it or Brian to sign it. You were both too busy meeting your publics last week, but hopefully
next time
I will.
Well, Jack, you'll have a signature.
OK, well, stay on the line to talk about our final great life.
Okay.
We're going to move on from Brian Robinson to a quite different cyclist, Anne Musto. Tim.
Anne Musto, who enjoyed significant success as an author, but I think because she hadn't started her life as a cyclist and really came to it quite late in life at 54, perhaps isn't quite recognised by cyclists as she might, but she's a remarkable woman. She had a business career, then she became a school teacher and became head of quite a posh girls' boarding school, and then at the age of 54 decided she was going to chuck it all in, traded in her Kurt Geiger shoes and Alfa Romeo for a bicycle and cycled around the world. And she carried on cycling, really, thereafter. She wrote, and her books are, she was very, very highly cultured. She was a classicist from Cambridge. And you know, she experienced travel as this very highly cultured thing, and actually has really interesting things to say, for example, about the construction of Roman roads and the way in which views were developed in roads. I mean, so it isn't just for your high culture buffs. But it's quite a cultured thing,
and it's certainly not the kind of get your head down and just get around the world. Like, so I'm being a bit disappointed by these people who ride around the world and try and get around as fast as they can and get a TV series out of it, but you know, what's the point of riding around the world if you don't stop to look at the world?
She did months of research before each ride so that she, you know, she both knew what buildings she'd be seeing. She searched out, I mean, she searched out ancient roads that had been used since, you know, prehistorical times. And they form many of her routes. So there's a kind of a fascination with both culture and travel, I think, that she has that you don't find with some of the faster riders.
Well, Tim has set me up with a reading that he's refused to do, and I think it's going to be pretty obvious why he's refused to. But I'm going to chance it. This is from A Bike Ride, 12,000 Miles Around the World by and Musto. And this is where our author finds herself in Rome. My own entry on a bicycle was more modest, but still exhilarating. I crossed the Piazzale Flaminio and cycled through the Porta del Popolo into the magnificence of the Piazza del Popolo. The inner face of the Porta, on the site of the ancient Porta Flaminia, was embellished in 1655 by Bernini for the state entry into Rome of Queen Christina of Switzerland. The Piazza del Popolo itself is a breathtaking collection of monuments, from the central obelisk, brought by Augustus from Heliopolis after the conquest of Egypt and moved to its present site by Pope Sixtus V as part of his city plan, to the exuberant fountains and statues of Valadier, who laid out the piazza in honour of the return of Pope Pius VII from France in 1814, the Borghese Gardens to the left, and the Baroque churches of Santa Maria dei Miracoli and Santa Maria in Monte Santo complete this overwhelming complex. I parked my bicycle outside a church door to take some photographs, and received a stern reprimand from an anxious young man.
Well done, Jack. I think you made a far better job of that than I ever could have done. She's not always quite so like a tourist guide, but they're really worthwhile books. She sadly passed away almost exactly a year ago at the age of 76, but by then she'd 6 books of long-distance rides and really quite a character.
And she was riding up until the very end, I think.
She was on a ride in Syria when she became ill and died, sadly.
Graham, did you meet Anne Musto?
No, I didn't, no. I knew of her, and I haven't yet read her, but that really has whet my appetite.
Well, let's move on now to the final in our quartet of great lives. Tim, you're going to introduce this one, Tim Dawson.
Laurent Fignon, who died a couple of months ago, I guess was the last real superstar of French cycling. Won 2 tours in the early 1980s and then suffered some really quite dramatic disappointments for much of the rest of his career. But, I mean, as well as being an immensely popular figure in France ever since, he produced last year a memoir called We Were Young and Carefree, which, even although at that time he knew he was going to die, is so rich in joie de vivre and joy at cycling that it's a really uplifting read.
Graham, you have had the privilege of meeting Laurent Fignon.
Mm-hmm. Yes. I've always admired him hugely. He's one of the very few of the ex-pros who really tell the truth. They cut the crap, you know. His comments on riders and races in L'Equipe were always very, very blunt, candid, and I thought highly intelligent. Of course, he was accused of being caustic and acerbic. I didn't find him so. I found him immensely charming, very, very intelligent, and very forthcoming. Similar to many of the riders whom I have interviewed, no side or ego. I mean, of course they have ego on the bike, but off it, they know that they've ridden their races. They don't have to talk them anymore. I was hugely sad when he died.
And he was, in some ways, the last of a certain generation, do you think, of cyclists?
Oh, yeah, certainly. I mean, he might never be described as Le Patron, as Hino might have been, but he was a rider who really could take hold of a race and dominate it. But also he, you know what you've just said about the joie de vivre in his memoir. He also had that in his riding. There seemed to be that kind of mischief in him that he took it part of it as a joke. But he just loved the whole deal of being good, showing he was good, and working bloody hard to prove it.
Just one quick line from his book, which kind of sums up his feelings about cycling. And when I got on my bike, the call of the wild infected me with blasts of emotion. I had the feeling that I could conquer everything, and would, even although I didn't know how or why. I would be dragged along by merely yearning for it, like an explorer in new territory. You find little runs of sentences like that throughout the book, which makes it sort of uplifting. It stayed with me all summer after I'd read it.
Yeah.
He did look like the professor, but there was a sort of cerebral other side to him. In the same vein of Eric Cantona, is that fair? Or,
well, he certainly didn't do bullshit. I mean, I don't think he would have talked about sardines and trawlers and seagulls. That wouldn't be his style. But I absolutely agree. Yes, he saw it, and that's why the French approach to the Tour and bike racing in general has always attracted me, because they see it as a bit more than just men on wheels or women on wheels going faster than the other people. There is something deep, and the metaphysics of it is what stirs them as well, and it does me. And I think Fignon actually triggered just that response, and that's why I warm to him. I know.
Well, from the art of cycle sport to the art of cycle construction. And the last time you heard Tim Dawson on the show prior to his appearance today was when he was with Gavin Turk looking at Les Bikes de Bois Rondes, the art project down in Essex. And there is an artefact which we have as a competition prize, a set of postcards of the bikes made by Gavin Turk that has been kindly donated by the project to be given away. And Tim, a question.
I do. Well, I have two possible questions.
We've only got one prize. So.
Well, my second one was really as a tiebreak. The first one, what did Gavin Turk's famous blue plaque assert that he had done and when? And in case we get two answers in the same, who get the answer right, what's the name of the Polish artist upon whom Turk's Bikes de Bois Rondes are based?
OK, the blue plaque. Why did he get the blue plaque? And the inspiration for Les Bikes de Bois Rondes, a Polish artist. Who is that? Answers by email, please, bikeshow@resonancefm.com. That's it for this week. Many thanks to Graham Fife. Look out for his book on Brian Robinson, and Tim Dawson doing sterling work bringing bicycling books to wider public acclaim. The website is
www.cycling-books.com.
Thank you. Until next time, here's the bell raise.
You're listening to Resonance 104.4 FM. That was another excellent instalment of The Bike Show. Coming next, a repeat of One Life Left from last week.